Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry endorses Ron DeSantis for governor and tries to blame his predecessor for the city's wave of violent crime. Controversy after PBS NewsHour interviews a top local newspaper editor about freedom of the press. And it turns out there's a strong local connection to the feud between President Trump and his former employee, Omarosa. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, what a busy week it was. We'll talk about all the week's top stories with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's a party with a purpose as the Northeast Florida AIDS Network holds its second annual block party this weekend to prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS in Duval. How you can be part of that, too. All of that ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Mark Woods, columnist for the Florida Times Union. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Our own regular contributor, Fred Matthews, is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And new to the roundtable, Madeline Peck Wagner, who writes for Folio Weekly. Good morning.
Good morning.
So much to talk about this week. Did you know Omarosa lives here and her husband does, and she has a local lawyer? We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about new development in the city. Even Jalen Ramsey makes the cut this week. Lots happening all around the town. But first this morning, as anguish grows around a rash of recent fatal shootings in Jacksonville, on Thursday, Mayor Lenny Curry seemed to place the blame on the city's continuing awful crime rate on the previous mayoral administration, even though Alvin Brown has been out of office for over 3 years. Here's Curry.
We're going to keep fighting our way out of the hole that the past put us in. I'm in charge now. This is what the cards have been dealt, but I'm working for families every day.
Okay. Curry, by the way, also endorsed Congressman Ron DeSantis for governor this week as the two made an appearance in Jacksonville together. But we're going to begin the roundtable with a look at how this administration is handling this city's continuing problem with gun violence. We want your calls at 549-2937. What do you think? Is Curry within his rights to continue to blame the city's crime rate on Alvin Brown, who's been out of office for 3 years? Curry ran for mayor successfully by criticizing Alvin Brown's handling of public safety after he had been in office for about 3 years. Curry owns this now. So what are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Mark Woods.
Yeah, you're right. That was a key part of his campaign. We kind of had a wave of crime happen then, and I think it probably was a factor that pushed him into office. And I think we've said at that point, if it didn't subside, you know, I don't know that it was. I don't know that it's ever fair to completely say, "Oh, a mayor should stop this." It's, you know, it's obviously such a complex thing. So,
it isn't fair, but in politics, they get blamed. Right. Alvin Brown was held accountable for
right.
this.
So if you're going to do it, then I think yes, you would hope that this far into it, it would have decreased. And if not, I would say the blame's on Mary Curry. Although I wouldn't say that. I think, as I said, it's very complex. So for him, yeah, to be still kind of pointing fingers back at the past, it just seems petty.
Yeah. Madeline Peck Wagner, they've made arrests in the shooting death of 7-year-old Heidi Rivas Villanueva. She was caught in the crossfire in a shooting on the west side. A woman was shot at a McDonald's drive-through last week, shot and killed. This endless drumbeat of gun violence and homicides in this city has been a scourge for a couple of decades now through multiple mayoral administrations. And so it's not as though this is a new issue. But at the same time, as the mayor campaigns for reelection, certainly a challenger could point to this as a failure on his part the same way he did when he took on Alvin Brown.
I think you're absolutely right. I grew up in a part of town in Cleveland, Ohio, where we had concerns about gunshots, you know, the same kinds of concerns. And I think it goes less to a problem specifically with, say, policing or with the current administration, and it goes to a larger systemic problem that does not address things like education, after school programs, community aid, and community services. So I think, and I've thought this for a long time, that Jacksonville is fairly stratified along race and cultural lines, that you have to look at it from a from an entire body point of view. And I know that's not really a solution or even a soundbiteable idea, but that's kind of where I think you start.
Right. Well, you know, that was attempted, if you go all the way back to the Peyton administration, Fred and Tim, the Jacksonville Journey attempted to take this comprehensive approach to bringing down homicides in the city, providing the kind of family strengthening and child support services. There was a whole range of programs that started with the Journey. They saw their funding get cut again and again. They're still in existence, but they have not been as effective, I don't think, as it could have been, right, had it continued in a robust way.
There was always that challenge of the Journey was focused long-term. It was basically saying, we're going to work with children now so that when they grow up, they don't, you know, go and shoot people. Before, you know, a four-year mayoral administration to go, this is valuable because those kids haven't grown up yet and changed their life course. So it's an easy thing for politicians to cut. I do know that Brown probably would argue that he did focus on things like job programs in these neighborhoods because he saw that as a way to cut down on violence. One of the things that always amuses me is our mayoral races focus on education and crime when we have an elected school board and an elected sheriff. And it always seems somewhat weird to me that mayors will run going, you know, my predecessor didn't make the city safe. Our kids aren't being educated. Well, that's not necessarily the mayor's responsibility. And frankly, they get tagged for, there's a wave of violence happening under your watch. I don't know what you actually expect a mayor to do about it, you know, in a direct this week sort of way.
Still, though, that's what became the deciding issue. 3 years ago, Fred, Lenny Curry, as a candidate for mayor, claimed that Jacksonville's crime rates were exploding under Mayor Alvin Brown. In actuality, violent and property crime rates overall were down, although the gun violence continued unabated under Brown, just as it does under Curry.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, it does seem to be a bit Trumpian, doesn't it? Bring it on your predecessor, bring it on the guy that came before me. And here we are, as we've said, I mean, we're 2 years now into his administration. He's spent a lot of time hugging babies out at Eureka Gardens and doing all of that. And still, here we are. The problem, as we all note, that politicians have a difficult time is telling the populace the truth. Jacksonville is going through, what Jacksonville is going through is nothing compared to what they're going through in Chicago, what they went through in Detroit. And one of the things that they're having to deal with
is the mayor of Chicago is getting hammered over the crime rate, Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah, they're calling for his resignation, along with, again, the second police chief he's had there since he's been mayor.
Here's a different thing, though. That's an appointed police chief. So I can blame the mayor more in a situation where he's responsible for the public safety apparatus.
Well, that's understandable, but the truth has to be told here. You cannot prevent, no one could have predicted that in the young village, in the way of shooting, that those gentlemen were going to be there at that time to shoot that girl. No one would have predicted that at the beaches, the young rapper would have been at that place at 2:30 in the morning. And as we now come to find out, may have even, you know, he ran up to the car and got shot, is what one of the perpetrators is saying. No one can predict that. We don't have pre-crime, as many people would like to have. A lot of this comes back to, in Washington Heights and other places, you've got to talk. The police job is what? The police job is to investigate and arrest. We have a shot spotter, but guess what? It only spots the shots after they've happened. And by the time the cops get there, you're either going to find a body or they're going to find nothing. A lot of this rests with the citizenry. And unfortunately, politicians, the mayor included, are not willing to tell the populace the truth about what's going on. And of course, at the root of this is what? GUNS. And that's where we are. And the mayor has simply run out of options. He doesn't have anything else to say. He's put money into it. He's visited. But, you know, there's nothing more he can really do. The populace has got to work it.
Right. When, as you point out, Melissa, when you look at the crime rate, the gun crime rate is a different thing than the crime rate.
Yes.
And there's a certain amount of those who would argue for more restrictions on guns would say, if we remove or we limit that part of the equation, we'll have the same number of crimes. But you know, two dudes beating each other up is different than
right.
an innocent child getting killed by a stray bullet.
Now, and not to get lost in this discussion is also the fact that this week Curry endorsed Ron DeSantis for governor. What are your thoughts about that, everybody?
I mean,
well, that's what he should do, right? I mean, he's the big dog. I mean, again,
Madeline.
This is Trump.
Madeline.
Perhaps he wants to be in a commercial, too. I don't know.
But think about the fact that in this city, the donor class, as they're called, the Republican donor class, they're split on this governor's race. Quite a few of them would prefer Adam Putnam. The mayor went out on the right edge of the political spectrum and said, I'm going to tie my name to Ron DeSantis, seems to be the nominee at this point.
Right. And Curry is a astute reader of the political winds. And I mean, it's hard. I don't think this was necessarily a surprise that he would endorse the same candidate that Trump's endorsed.
Yeah, I'm not surprised either. I mean, if you've been watching even Lenny Curry's tweets, he kind of gets a little bombastic. And then after Trump was elected, he was certainly elated. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think that's the lane that he wants to be in.
Yeah, it felt to me like here's the front runner and jump on board now. And, you know, if he is indeed the nominee, I can say I was there when you were running in the primary. So
let's go to your calls as we discuss crime, politics, and more here on the Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. Gail is in Jack's Beach. Hi, Gail. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to compliment you on your show from yesterday. I thoroughly appreciated the show about the editorials in the newspapers.
Thanks. We're going to talk about that again in a minute. Yeah.
Oh, okay,
thank
great.
You. Go ahead, though.
The other thing I wanted to comment on was it seems that the standard now is for politicians to always blame the previous person who held the office, and that's a standard that I think needs to go away. And that's my comment.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And here's a tweet from Josh. I hope that all of the voters who helped elect Mayor Curry due to their perception that Alvin Brown didn't do enough to combat violent crime will be just as critical about the current mayor's inability to address the same problem. It's only fair. I remember the mailers, Fred, back in 2015, rape and murder are up 35% under Alvin Brown. And so will someone step forward? Will an Anna Broche or a Garrett Dennis step forward and start that drumbeat against this incumbent or not? Do they think it's not a winnable race?
I think that's the big question in Jacksonville politics of, how vulnerable is Curry? I mean, nobody has stepped up yet that, you know, with a serious campaign, and it will be interesting to see what happens there.
Well, I mean, it's going to be difficult for any of them at this point. I mean, we're talking about I understand he has close to $2 million war chest and counting. He'll probably have as much money as Congressman DeSantis will have running for governor before it's all over. And I mean, that's the real politic of this, whether it's Broche or, I mean, there's some talk on the outside of even Garrett Dennis doing it. They simply don't have the juice to do it. And Broche would not get the endorsement of the Republican Party, her own party, for this. It's just not there. So, I mean, I don't see anything stopping Curry from getting a second term. And so he's pretty much free to do what he wants to do and say what he wants to say. And again, as we get closer up on that primary election next spring, I mean, we'll probably begin to really see what he wants to get done at that point. But at this point, it's just not realistic to think anybody's going to be able to do anything with this.
549-2937. What do you think, everybody? Bonnie is at the beaches. Hi, Bonnie. Good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning. Thank you for taking the call again. You know, as a citizen, I have to say that I'm extremely disappointed in the performance of the mayor and city council and JSO. It seems the only time you see Mayor Curry's voice concern over crime rate is when he's running for office. And I think back to little Tashawn Gallen, who was shot at the first of the year. You know, the only time you see Curry is when there's a media opportunity for him to express concern. And, you know, one caller said...
Well, to be fair, he has talked about this a lot, to be fair to him. But go ahead.
But one of your panelists said, what do you expect from a mayor? I think I would expect the mayor to have a long-term vision that would not only build the business into the city, but that would take in the part of the city, which is its people. And when you've got economic and social justice issues such as we have in Jacksonville that are reflected through the violence that we see. And yes, guns are the weapons of choice. If you go back and look at the FDLE stats, last year over 1,800 aggravated assaults where guns were the weapon of choice, 112 murders with guns. We've got a gun problem. I personally have spoken at city council twice asking them why, as permitted by the Florida Constitution, do they not pass a law closing the gun show loophole in Jacksonville for Duval County? They can do that. They have not responded. Several grassroots organizations have signed letters and sent them to city council asking them to take action to do something to stop the flow of guns. And we know that's going to be hard. And this is just one little thing they could do, but it's something they could do. But there's not a strategy. There's not a leadership vision to bring this city together. The distrust between JSO and the black community is one of the big, big dividers. And I think problems we have in solving the violence issue, but yet there's no concrete long-term action in place to address that. And as a citizen, I'm extremely disappointed. And I hope there is very good challengers in the race this year for JSO, sheriff, and for the mayor.
Bonnie, thanks for that.
Well, I think, you know, that's the issue. There is that divide. The majority of black community votes Democratic. And that's one of the issues.
And what about what she said about if you're a person of color in this city, are you less likely to call the police, say, if you know about something that happened? And police might need that information.
No, I don't think that's an issue of you being less likely. There are a number of people who call the police on a regular basis. The issue is still the same. The police job is to investigate and arrest. It is not to prevent crimes. If they can, that's fine. But we can't afford to put a police officer on every corner at every convenience store all the time. It has to be a community education effort that has to get into these communities and work with them. There was a program that we had now about 15, 20 years ago. That did have advocates in those communities who knew the gangs, who could talk their language, who could work with them almost like social workers to try to bring down the effort of violence that we had. Putting money into graveyards as a part of the budgetary thing, although it's nice, good cleanup thing, it's not what the black community necessarily needs to solve that problem that we're talking about. And that's the nitty-gritty.
You're talking about everything from community policing, which JSO does, to just community development work, you know, which is some of that is not the police's purview, but some of it, you know, police officers building relationships in communities is part of what Fred's talking about. And JSO would say, yeah, we do that. But clearly, we continue to fail at this Jacksonville, Florida. It's a collective failure. And it's been that way for a long time. A long time. This is not, I can't count the number of times we've talked about this issue on this program. It's unbelievable how often we talk about this. It's a collective societal failure.
And I think Fred is right in that it's not the police's job to stop crimes before they occur. That's not their role. But as a city, as a community, saying, what can we do to develop more jobs in that area? What can we do to deal with blight in those areas where we put it to a point where people don't want to kill each other, don't need to, you know, get involved in drug deals because they can't get another job. And, you know, you look at dealing with recidivism rates, you look at education, you look at all of these things that should be dealt with, not by JSO, but very possibly by the city government, by the Curry administration.
Johnny in Washington Heights. Go ahead, Johnny.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
My question is, when are we going to talk about some of the systemic issues that cause that gun violence and at the root of it? Because more than it being a gang problem, it's more of an economic thing and an opportunity thing. And I think we spend too much time spending our funds on the policing rather than coming up with effective solutions that can help this from stop happening.
Madeline, Mark.
Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, I mean, going back to the previous callers.
I feel like John McLaughlin. Mark Ward! Sorry, go
we've
ahead.
We've talked about what a mayor can do. I do wonder, you know, we've had kind of tipping points where Dershana Davis kind of sparked the Jacksonville.
That was during that's what sparked Mayor Payton to start the Jacksonville journey.
Right. Yeah. So I'm wondering whether, you know, that was one of my thoughts when I heard about this shooting. I think this one hit people in a little bit different way, of the little 7-year-old Heidi, whether this could be one of those that sparks something different. Because I think everybody's heart broke over this one. You know, it happens at 6 p.m. in a parking lot, just caught in the middle of something. I wonder, will this spark us to take a different approach than just, you know, increased police presence and some of the things and a more, as this last caller mentioned, a more comprehensive plan, something akin to the Jacksonville journey.
Jim tweets the show, Duval and Florida conservatives won't do anything about guns because they're afraid they'll lose all of that Russian money. Oops, I meant to say NRA money. That's another kettle of fish, but thanks for that tweet. And we want to shift gears and talk about some other news of the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. Okay, also making headlines this week, the Florida Times Union joined hundreds of other newspapers around the country in a coordinated response to President Trump's ongoing attacks on the media. Editorials ran nationwide, criticizing Trump for calling the press the enemy of the people, and they also defended the vital importance of a free press and the First Amendment. It was remarkable to see the TU join this effort, considering the TU was one of only two major newspapers in America who endorsed Trump for president back in 2016. Mike Clark, editorial page editor for the Times Union, appeared on the PBS NewsHour last night with Judy Woodruff. Take a listen.
What do you think needs to be done? You say in the editorial today that there's work to be done now on both sides.
Well, I used to be a newspaper ombudsman for 15 years, and I think the major media outlets that have some revenue need to reappoint ombudsmen to do a little soul searching to look at how they're doing. I think, you know, the Shorenstein Center in Harvard said the first 100 days of the Trump administration set a new standard for unfavorable press coverage of a president. So the news media needs to do some soul searching on their side. At the same time, the president needs to lower the rhetoric. Maybe we can find somebody to do some mediation between the two.
We need to point out that after Clark's editorial ran and after his appearance on PBS last night, his own colleagues, reporters at the Times Union, strongly criticized him on social media for appearing to draw what they perceived as a false equivalence between the president's war on the media and mistakes and overreach made by the media.
There's good people on both sides.
Okay.
Oh, so, you beat me to it.
All right. Madeline Peck Wagner. Mike Clark's a pretty conservative guy. The editorial page is pretty conservative. What did you think of that editorial?
I mean, I thought that it was kind of, you know, very fine people on both sides kind of thing. It's an attempt at mitigation, but I think the blame really rests with the thin-skinned narcissist who sits in the Oval Office. The media has been a founding part of our country. I mean, newspapers, ideas of truth. It's how we hold the people in power accountable. And if you can't, first of all, if you don't like being criticized, don't act in a manner that leaves you wide open to criticism. And do your homework, dude. Like, read the Constitution. Pay attention. I mean, I know Frederick Douglass has been dead for a long time.
All right, Tim Gibbons.
There is an interesting argument embedded in that idea of what President Trump has been the most criticized. We cover business. We don't really wade into politics a lot, but we get a similar sort of pushback if we're writing about a company that's not doing well. And the response is, well, but the company's not doing well. So there's a certain amount of if it's viewed as negative coverage, but it's factual negative coverage, that's not bias, that's just coverage. Business Journal also editorialized on this topic this week. And I think that one of the things that is easy to miss in talking about this entire thing is that the point of this entire kind of loose collection of people coming together, newspapers coming together to write about this, is responding to the attack on a free press. It's not an attack on Trump's policies or plans, but you know, Trump's not calling out the Jacksonville Business Journal as fake news, but we have people who have, you know, who've used that term to apply to a speech. They just don't like the coverage. And I think that is a dangerous idea. If we can't join together and say that finding out information and analyzing it and communicating it is a good thing for the country, that's a problem.
I read the entire editorial on the air yesterday and took a lot of calls about it. And, you know, two thoughts come to mind. First, it's remarkable the Times Union participated in this effort, considering the overall slant of the TU op-ed page. And second, there is clearly a lot of dissension in the ranks between the reporters and the op-ed page at the Times Union. And it must be pointed out they are completely separate, Mark Woods. And so when President Trump was endorsed by the Times Union in 2016, people actually canceled their subscriptions to the Times Union because they were very upset about that endorsement. And the reporters and writers such as yourself at the time took pains to point out that you had nothing to do with that decision and that you're not in a position of writing opinion pieces. Well, you are, but your colleagues aren't in a position of writing opinion pieces. And so, you know, to see Mike Clark on PBS last night saying, yes, the president needs to dial down the rhetoric, but we need to bring back the ombudsman role for newspapers. Would an ombudsman make a difference in this climate? Is that a solution, do you think, to, or is it more what Madeline said, that the papers, you might not like what newspapers and media outlets are reporting, but they are reporting on this administration, for the most part, accurately in covering the scandals of this administration?
Yeah, I think we need to stand up for ourselves and, you know, push back against this idea of fake news. So I was glad to see newspapers around the country do this. But another thing is, that, you know, often the media is perceived as monolithic, which is just kind of silly. You know, within, you know, just this is a kind of a prime example. Within one newsroom, there's a wide range, wide spectrum of views, you know, and I didn't even know Mike was on PBS till I came in here. I was busy watching soccer last night.
You don't watch our station every night?
You guys, how could you choose between the riveting action of soccer and the riveting action of PBS?
I was surprised by this. But I was glad to see papers around America push back. And yes, ours was a different tone. But I guess maybe, you know, I was when we endorsed Trump, I wrote how I was embarrassed. And I didn't have that same reaction to this as some of my colleagues did. I felt like, we didn't maybe push back in the same way, but I read it differently than some of them. The idea that the first 100 days of some of the most negative coverage, you know, on day one, the president is saying, I had the largest inauguration crowd ever. I mean, what do you do with that when it's flat out false? So do you just go, okay, or do you say, no, it's not? So I think there's a reason, back to Tim's point about a company doing poorly, when there's so many falsehoods and lies spread in the first 100 days, yes, there's going to be a lot of negative coverage. But I guess to Mike's point, he's trying to, maybe dial back. You know, I've tried to avoid.
Would an ombudsman do that? Fulfill that role, as Mike Clark said.
And do you want the job?
No,
I know you don't want that job. Let's go to Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom.
Yes. Good morning. I just wanted to point out that there is an excellent play by Ibsen called "Enemy of the People," where it turns out the enemy of the people and his warnings to the populace is absolutely right, and there was a real threat. And I just want to echo what was just said there. If Trump brings this upon himself by all the egregious breaches of the norm that his presidency has brought to us, if he was acting like anything within the norm, he would not have so many problems with the media because he would be doing things that the American people would approve of.
There's a tweet about, thank you, Tom. There's a tweet from Josh saying much the same. There are two reasons for negative coverage of Trump. One, people like it and it drives ad dollars. And two, Trump violates norms of the presidency that journalism has taken for granted. So they are merely pointing out those violations. Okay. Speaking of Donald Trump, did you know that local attorney John Phillips is representing former White House staffer Omarosa? Did you know that Omarosa lives here and has a husband who lives here? Yes, it's true. Her book Unhinged details her 11 months inside the White House before she was fired. And it's been hard to miss her whirlwind book tour this week on basically every network, where she's been dropping several recordings of conversations she secretly obtained with everyone from the president to White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, and probably many more to come. Omarosa's husband is Pastor John Allen Newman at the sanctuary at Mount Calvary Church on Kings Road. He proposed to her there right in front of the congregation. They lead the church together. Local attorney John Phillips is representing Omarosa. As the Trump campaign announced Tuesday, it had filed an arbitration action against her for allegedly breaching a non-disclosure agreement that she signed when she went to work in the White House. So what about this local connection to Omarosa?
So here I just said it. We should maybe not be as snarky. It's stories like this that make it hard not to go down that path. I mean, I saw somebody had tweeted, who in their right mind would record in the Situation Room? And people tweeted back, you know, who in the right mind would, you know, fill the White House with reality TV show stars.
Right. So if she did, in fact, at this point, there are so many things we could get into with this, but if she did, in fact, record her firing in the Situation Room, that's a skiff. That's a secure, compartmentalized, you know, you're not supposed to bring any recording devices in there. Okay. So there's so many things going on with this story, Fred. You know, the fact that John Phillips is representing her, the fact that her husband is a successful pastor here. They got married and had their reception, I think, at the White House last year. Yeah. She's in and out of Jacksonville. And so with John Phillips now taking this on, this has just become yet another mind-blowing element of covering this administration.
Well,
locally.
I mean, Attorney Phillips is basically preparing her for the suit that will be filed by the Trump campaign committee because of her clear violation of that agreement, the employment agreement that she had with them, and everybody had to sign. There's nothing they can really do about what she did or didn't do in the White House in terms of recording this, because as everybody has noted this week, any agreements that you sign in the White House, short of having a security clearance, is really nothing. So she can do whatever she wants because she never had any security clearance. But hey, we wanted reality TV, and we got it. We got it from the top reality star. Yeah. Omarosa helped make reality TV into what it is today, along with her boss. This is the second time she's been fired by the same boss. I mean, it is some great stuff, and Jacksonville gets to play all of it. Only thing left now is to gather around the churches at the end of Kings Road here. Just straight, go straight down Union Street, across it, all the way to the end of Kings Road. You'll find John Newman's church. Just stand there and see the press wait for her to make the next grand entrance and question poor John about this. I mean, he loves publicity, but I don't think he wanted this much.
It is. They're talking about publicity. It is a good time to be a lawyer who wants to go on TV or to have an explosive tell-all book. Reportedly, Trump's wife basically cautioned him to not tweet about it. You know, everyone around was like, just ignore her. And of course, he couldn't help himself.
Tweeted seven times,
right? And the idea that you
that'll
saw
drive
you saw
book sales.
You saw it with saw it with Fire and Fury, where it went nuts because of that.
And Fire and Fury was a terrible book. I read it. Like, I could not read it, but it was awful.
You read the book?
I read the book. As soon as I could, and it didn't say anything that was. That you didn't already suspect or like feel in your bones.
To speak
to Fire and Fury.
I read your column, Mark, and Trump's about to attack your book.
That's what I'm hoping for. Can we please get him to call Lassoing the Sun a fake book by a mentally deranged author,
and it'll low be, life. Yeah. How about that?
Add that in, and it'll climb the chart.
You will no longer have to do this roundtable because you will no longer be working, because you won't have to work if you sell that many copies of your book.
And in spite of the fact that in the president's tweet he called Omarosa a dog, in the end, there isn't really that much sympathy for Omarosa on the street. Yeah. There just is no sympathy. If she was hoping to sell a whole lot of books out of this, which is what she's looking to do, it's just not going to, it's not going to pan, because everybody that you can talk to says, well,
I will say, though, that in watching her in the interviews, she really, you know, she performs in a really plausible and sort of self-legitimizing manner when she speaks. I believe her, and which is not to say that it erases my knowledge of her as an apprentice villain and these sorts of things, but I think this actually might have some more meat to it. I'm also super excited for Discovery.
Yeah.
When this goes to court.
And according to John Phillips, he's declined an interview on this program for the time being. He's assembling a whole team to handle this arbitration. They essentially are trying to muzzle Omarosa. How do you muzzle Omarosa?
Well, I also thought when I saw this yesterday that it kind of has a Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels kind of feel to it. You have you know, a lawyer that's kind of gearing up and thinking about his public presence with who is sort of defending. I don't want to use the term damsel because I don't want to, you know,
You don't want to risk Stormy Daniels' reputation.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, I mean, but these are two high-profile, intelligent women who have occupied controversial places in our society. Mm-hmm. And so just from sort of a cultural, critical point of view, it's going to be fascinating to watch play out and to see if they're sort of, if Phillips takes moves from Avenatti's playbook. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right.
And to go to
to
go to Fred's point, there is a very real thing that, okay, this is a reality TV administration. In some ways, I think the fascinating thing is having Omarosa playing the reality TV villain role sort of thing, that this is her milieu as much as it's Trump. And I can see reality TV star and a pornographic film actress being more of the type of people who are going to come out with these stories that have a ring of truth, and they're playing on the same field. I mean, people are paying more attention to that than, you know, Wilbur Ross's financial
scandals.
By the way,
I think is terrible. And the reason I brought this up regarding this whole spectacle is because of the local connection. Otherwise, I wouldn't have put it in the show today. And it is unfortunate that there are really serious matters going on, and we're being distracted by this. But it's become a central aspect of this presidency.
Which, yeah, it seems to happen again and again and again when there's some really serious news out there. Something like this pops up, and you think it's hurting the Trump administration when it actually, in some ways, may just be look over here instead of over here.
And we are going to move on in a moment. One more call on this. John on the North Bank. Go ahead, John.
Melissa, thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, I'm standing. There is a local connection, and we have to remember that Jax, it's easier here.
But it is.
I'm on the North Bank in front of Sidney Geffen Park, and I really am hoping that Mark Woods and Omarosa will have a joint book signing, and then Mark can take her on the stand-up paddleboard, and when they get near TIAA Bank, they can have a loudspeaker where tear down these ramps. So thank you for taking my call, and love the show.
You could sell tickets for that.
I'm all in.
I can visualize that.
That is fantastic. that would be something I'd pay to see. Okay. In another slightly less sexy and tabloid-ready story, we do need to mention, finally, another proposal has been released about what to do with the land where the old county courthouse and city hall annex sit on Bay Street. They're just sitting there rotting while they're being demolished, and the new idea, Riverwalk Place, would go up in their place, a 5-story, 347-unit residential complex, a hotel, space for restaurants, a parking garage, but no convention center. Tim Gibbons, your thoughts.
It's a fascinating proposal, in part because the DIA goes down, the Downtown Investment Authority goes down this path of saying, okay, here's where we want to put a convention center. And that site, since the courthouse has been closed, was always seen. You have the Hyatt there, that was seen as that was the place for a convention center. Obviously, Iguana Investment comes in, says, no, we want it at the shipyards. people I talk to say there's a good chance of that happening. So then the question becomes, we have this, you know, decaying spot that something has to be done with. If you want downtown to be revitalized, you can't have a dead zone right there. So doing a massive mixed-use project, you know, there's movement on the basically that entire stretch along the riverfront. You have the Berkman project that's been sitting there. So you end up, now you start getting some synergies between the core of downtown stretching all the way to the entertainment sports district.
Well, I mean, it certainly says that somebody modified their proposal accordingly. Right. Seems how we can't have three convention centers or two.
Exactly.
So it's good to see that
gotta
they did it. I understand that there is some connection between Rimrock Development and the folks over at Iguana.
Rimrock was involved with Iguana Investments plan for the shipyards.
So it stands to reason that they've modified that and that seems to be something that can happen. Although the question just lies with me, where are we going to get all these people from, Mark? I mean,
they're all out at the same St. John's Town Center.
Right. No, I mean, that's a very good question.
Have you ever been to the St. John's Town Center and it wasn't packed?
Well, but that's
they're
a city.
There.
But that is a city unto itself. I'm never going to leave. I'm never going to leave the town center. I got everything I need out there except for City Hall. I'm sure they got a tax collector's office out there. So I don't need to go there.
If you get retail, you get residents. And if you get residents, you get, you know, more entertainment. And the problem with downtown development is the chicken and egg issue of people don't want to live downtown because there's not enough amenities and the amenities won't come downtown until there's more people. But, you know,
can this be good enough that we will attract the people and get over that hump?
That's actually a jump start. You know, right now the problem with downtown development is the rents that they can charge for residential isn't high enough to build more residential. So if somebody comes in and basically says, I'm doing residential as part of a major project, maybe that puts more housing, maybe that brings more people.
Okay. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do candidates for statewide... You don't like the new music? Only in Florida do candidates for statewide office get caught lying about graduating from college and even produce a fake diploma.
Whoa.
Melissa Howard over in the Sarasota area, I think, has dropped out of her race to be a member of the Florida House after it was revealed she had not graduated from Miami University in Ohio, and that the diploma she produced to show reporters was a fake. Howard even posed with her mom and the fake diploma to try to prove that the reporting on this was wrong.
Do we know that's her mom?
Yeah. And she called the reporting fake.
She called it fake news, but it was the diploma that was fake.
Photoshop is a hell of a drug.
She's out of the race. And only in Florida do defensive backs like Jalen Ramsey emerge as one of the top trash talkers in the NFL. Yes, the 23-year-old Ramsey, who, by the way, got suspended this week for lashing out at a local reporter, also gave an interview to GQ, where he sounded off on everything from the best and worst quarterbacks in the league to the need to change the culture in Jacksonville. Ramsey said, "We need to have the juice, the fire, that we don't care what other people think. We just go and get it."
Talking about putting a target on your back.
Yeah, he better play well this year.
Yeah. I hope he does. And thanks to Tim Gibbons, Madeline Peck Wagner, Fred Matthews, and Mark Woods. Guys, everybody, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
And
thank
we'll
you.
Be right back.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm supports the Hope and History Mural Project, commemorating Jacksonville's youth-led 1960 lunch counter sit-ins, the infamous Axe Handle Saturday, and the aftermath. The mural unveiling is August 25th at the Eastside Brotherhood Building.
WJCT listeners and viewers enjoy and support cultural events and activities. Many attend gallery openings, concerts, festivals, and art exhibits in Jacksonville and surrounding areas. Learn how to reach this audience by calling 358-6367.
on The Next Fresh Air, John le Carré talks about being a spy before he became known for writing espionage novels and creating the fictional spy, George Smiley, who's featured in the novel The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. Le Carré says he learned about deception from his father, who was a pathological liar. Le Carré's novel about George Smiley's protege is out in paperback. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, if you think that the tree of life is really like a tree, David Quammen is here to change your mind. He'll explain why new discoveries about ancient microbes are revamping our ideas about evolution. Plus, the Earth invented nuclear fission long before we did. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Italy declares a state of emergency and expects it to last a year. Carnage on the streets of Kabul as the Taliban withdraws protection for the Red Cross. Qatar comes to Turkey's rescue and from Russia with love. Austria's foreign minister welcomes a surprise guest at her wedding. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a block party with a purpose and the goal to prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS. The Northeast Florida AIDS Network is having its second annual youth block party tomorrow at A. Philip Randolph Park. Now, along with the games, music, food, school supply giveaways, there will also be HIV testing and outreach. This is so important because Duval County has one of the highest rates of HIV and AIDS in Florida and even the nation. Katrina Odell is a case manager with Northeast Florida AIDS Network. Hey, Katrina, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to see you. Also with us, Stephanie Reese. She's a manager with Community Rehabilitation Center.
Good morning.
Good to see you too. Okay. So the second time you've done this, Katrina, I guess last year was a big success.
Yes, last year was a big success. And this year we're looking for more participants. And we have about 48 vendors coming out there to the park who are all youth-centric, offering different resources available to our youth ages 13 through 24 years old.
So you're really targeting young people with music and food and fun. You want to get the word out to that population.
Definitely. We realized last year that kids need to be engaged, so therefore we're bringing in a lot of games, events. We're having a kickball game. We're bringing in the gaming truck, doing carnival-type games, free food, book bags, of course, lots of education and information in regards to health education.
And even some HIV testing.
Definitely. We will have the mobile units out there doing testing. The first 100 youth who come out and get tested will have incentives.
What kind of incentives?
We're doing gift cards, and also the mobile units will have little trinkets for our youth.
Okay, very nice. Stephanie Reese, let's talk about why this is such a critical public health issue for Jacksonville, HIV and AIDS.
Well, it's very critical because, as you know, we are leading still with newly reported cases in the nation, just as you indicated. We look at the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, and we receive data, and it's compiled through the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control, in partnership with Florida and the, in partnership with Duval County Schools. And they do this survey every other year. And the recent numbers indicate that youth are still having unprotected sex, mm-hmm. although they know, because the questions stem around, if you know about contraceptives, why aren't you still using them? And it's just an area of apathy. They feel like, you know, it won't happen to me. And so we still have issues and numbers leading with HIV, newly reported cases. And some that are out there, they won't get tested. They will not get tested. So they're spreading disease to more and more people.
Why are people reluctant to get tested? Do you think?
I think it has to do with confidentiality. They're kind of like, you know, I don't want to put myself in a position to, okay, I don't even want my friends to see me actually going to get tested, because then that says, okay, first I'm having sex. That also may indicate that I may be having unprotected sex. And then I don't want to necessarily be judged. My business is still my business. So we're fortunate to have the mobile units that are going to be there tomorrow, completely confidential. It's not something that, you know, all your friends can't go in there with you. It's one-on-one counseling, testing. testing and services for you, and you can get the help that you need in the event that you are reactive. And that's the new term that we use for positive.
If your test result
is reactive, then we can link you with care and services right
there. Why do you say that now instead of positive?
Well, because when they're doing the tests, my understanding from that is they were getting some false positives for different reasons. So now that the testing is a little more succinct and the materials that they're using, it's kind of like, okay, if you're reactive, it's more conclusive versus some of the false positives they were getting. And that was just linked with the individual. Sometimes it was something that medication, substance abuse, that would interfere with it. So now the reactive tests are a lot more conclusive and you can get a better reading with the new materials that we're using.
Okay. So an accurate test and a free test.
Yes.
Yeah. So how many kids and families are you hoping to see out there, Katrina?
Our goal this year is 500. Last year, we did complete surveys. We're believing we had about 118 youth out there last year being our first year, but we are definitely trying to reach a crowd of 500.
And for kids that might not want their parents to know about this, how do you get the word out to them?
So what we're recommending is that parents are dropping off the kids and letting them come out and participate and then coming back and picking them up. Children are not necessarily going to be their self in front of their parents. So if they just drop them off, it'll give us a better opportunity to reach the youth. If parents are wanting to come, we're not going to deter them. But at the same time, we'd rather that the youth come out on
their
own.
This is for the kids. Okay.
Yes.
It is the second annual Youth Block Party, courtesy of the Northeast Florida AIDS Network, tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at A. Philip Randolph Park. That's at 1096 APR Boulevard, just north of the football stadium. And one more thing?
Yes, just to clarify, it's the AHF AIDS Healthcare Foundation and all of Area 4 partners who are working together to do this. That includes the City of Jacksonville, Northeast Florida AIDS Network, CRC, River Regions, UF Cares, CAN Community Health, Jasmine, all of the Area 4 partners are in this together. So it's not just Northeast Florida AIDS Network. It's all Area 4 prevention
partners.
It's
effort.
A community event. Yeah. And it takes all of us to get this done.
All right. So make sure you're part of this tomorrow. If you're a young adult or if your teen wants to go to the Youth Block Party. And thanks, Katrina Odell with NFAN, Stephanie Reese with Community Rehabilitation Center. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, too. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new statewide call-in program, The Florida Roundup. Also, a special show Monday at 9 a.m. when our guests will be the Democratic candidates for Florida's 5th Congressional District, incumbent Al Lawson and challenger, former Mayor Alvin Brown. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. This is 89.9. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.